minutes to present your case. Thereafter, the members will be asking you questions. And I'm going to give you the opportunity to share with us what you have brought here and tell South Africans as well. As you know, this is also live, so other people at home can see you. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Kajal Ramjathan Keo. I have a short presentation focusing on what you've asked for. Firstly, on the role and functions of the public protector. And in brief, the public protector has the power to investigate any conduct into state affairs, public administration into any sphere of government that is suspected to be improper or resulted in impropriety, to report on that conduct and to take appropriate remedial action. The public protector is to receive reports of maladministration and abuse in state affairs and recommend remedial orders. The public protector is the champion of anti-corruption and clean governance. The office or the institution is subject only to the constitution and the law. The institution is required to report to Parliament and to account to the National Assembly. In addition to the Constitution and the Public Protector Act, there are some cases which have clarified the Public Protector's role. The most recent has been the EFF versus Speaker of the National Assembly, where the Constitutional Court clarified the legal effect of the Public Protector's powers and importantly said that remedial action recommended by the Public Protector is binding. To move on to my experience and the integrity that you were seeking from somebody in my position, I am currently the Executive Director of the Southern Africa Litigation Centre, which is a regional non-governmental organisation based in Johannesburg and operating in 10 Southern African countries. The mandate of this organization is to protect the rule of law and to strengthen human rights. Prior to this position, I spent 12 years at Lawyers for Human Rights, mostly in the refugee and migrant rights sector, but also engaged in detention monitoring and child rights and citizenship and statelessness. I have management experience, and this includes management of staff and projects and cases in multiple locations. I continue to oversee cases and projects in the 10 countries that SALC operates in. To give you an idea of the kinds of cases that I've worked on over the years, I'm sorry that the text is very small in this one. The Center for Child Law versus the Minister of Home Affairs is a case from 2005 where I came across a number of unaccompanied foreign children detained at the Lindela Repatriation Centre. Following several months of protracted litigation, we got an outcome from the High Court which said that there was a positive duty on government departments to formulate and implement practical arrangements regarding unaccompanied foreign children found in South Africa, and that children should only be detained as a matter of last resort. There have been numerous other immigration detention cases creating jurisprudence in this area, important jurisprudence, such as the 120 days maximum period of detention, immigration detention. More recently, in 2015, I was involved in a case in Botswana challenging the Botswana government's refusal to grant access to antiretrovirals to foreign prisoners. This was a successful challenge. We are monitoring the implementation currently. In 2015, I was involved in a case where my organization sought the implementation of an arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who arrived in the country for the AU summit. This was based on an International Criminal Court warrant which had been issued for him, and for which he was a fugitive from justice for failing to present himself to the International Criminal Court. The application was successful. However, the state refused to detain Mr. Bashir in the country in order for him to be arrested. I have experience of drafting submissions and reports. These include shadow reports to the United Nations, the African Commission, the AU, SADC, including AU commissioners and UN special mechanisms. I've made parliamentary submissions. I've supported Chapter 9 investigations. I have drafted some publications. I'll move on a little bit to innovation and creativity. Several years ago, I set up a project looking at statelessness and access to citizenship, which project has developed into a self-standing project, which is now leading statelessness and access to citizenship in the region. I've also, four years ago, created a special Lawyers for Human Rights project to look into the situation of Mozambican mine workers and their access to socioeconomic and other rights once they leave South Africa and their employment. I was co-author of an idea to set up a mobile phone technology information service for refugees in South Africa, which developed an application which is now fully operational, where refugees can register for a service, receive information, and seek advice on their particular situations. I have worked on migrants' rights, right of asylum seekers and refugees, and citizenship. I have worked on child rights and detention of children. I'm currently involved in several freedom of expression and media defense cases in Swaziland and Lesotho. I have, in my many years of public interest work, promoted constitutional rights, including the right to dignity, freedom of security of the person, and I've worked on women's rights as well, which includes sexual reproductive health rights and women's land and property rights.
You have 2 more minutes remaining.
I'm done.
Oh, you're done?
Yes.
Oh, well done. Thank you. Okay. Members, there you are. I'm going to start from this side now. I have to be fair. Yes, Honorable Motapo, I'm going to start with you. Then Honorable Maisela, Honorable Tseke, do you have your hand up or you are just patient through? Oh, okay. Honorable Tseke and Honorable Pongo. Honorable Van Damme, you are doing this. I'm not sure whether you wanted to raise your question or you're not sure. Oh, must I recognize you? Okay, I recognize you. Let me take those 5 for now. Then I will move to the next. You will come. Don't worry. Okay? Yes, Honorable Motapo.
Welcome. Thank you, Chairperson. Good evening, Ms. What's the surname? Kyo. In your own admission on page 6, section 2, motivational, you state that you don't have a civil society experience, which you have is from a civil society perspective, which may not be palatable to government. Protect me, Chairperson. Honorable Britain is intimidated.
Very protected,
yes.
Honorable member, and
yes.
I would call on the member who is interrupting you to refrain from doing that. Proceed, Honorable member.
And then you continue saying you acknowledge this, and nevertheless, you are a person of integrity and honesty. May you then elaborate on this, and why do you think you are a fit and proper person, whereas in your own admission, you admit that you are not, you know, the experience you have is not the one required for such. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Honorable Maisala.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to quote you What you have said here, and then maybe we can take it from there. For a open quote, for a constitution to have a meaningful place in the heart, it must address the concern of people. That is, you are quoting former Chief Justice Sandile Ngcobo. He added that corruption, racism, violent protest, the slow pace of service delivery, and access to land were all threats to the country's constitutional democracy. I agree with this and believe these are all key challenges facing our country. Transformation of South African society is important and should seek to redress key harms of the past and develop society into a future founded on social justice. Now, as a public protector, if you are appointed, how are you going to carry out this injunction that former Chief Justice Ngcobo has just articulated and that you have quoted so aptly? Thank you.
Thank you very much and good evening, ma'am. Around last year, in 2015, some of the regional offices of the public protector were closed down, and the reasons behind that is lack of finances. And thus far, our communities are struggling to get the services of the public protector. If you are appointed, how would you make sure that our rural poor, our disadvantaged, can be able to get services that is closer to them? And the other question, Chair, is on the issue of, you know, our country has three arms of the state, and that is the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive. And my question relates to the legislature. Suppose you are employed or you are appointed to be a public protector and you receive a complaint and an allegation of financial impropriety against a public office bearer of the national legislative arm of the state. How would you respond to such a case? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tseke.
Thank you and good evening.
I was just asking.
Mine will be about my question borders around two aspects. The fit and properness, because you'll appreciate that the Act, Public Protectors Act, envisages that the incumbent must be fit and proper. But secondly, the independence, as we have also alluded to, but the public protector must be independent. So mine will be I want you to share with us your view of the independence, what constitutes this independence, and what constitutes fit and properness in the light of what we call national unity. You know why I'll quote national unity is that from time to time as members of parliament, when we go outside the country, we go with EFF members, ANC members, DA members, SACDP members. So whatever we're told when we get out of the country, we're told that we must promote what we call national unity. So I want you to give a comment of independence of the public protector, your fit and properness as a candidate in the light of the Omar al-Bashir case that you strongly felt that the state did not comply. And you must link that with your understanding of this office being an enemy of the state, in a sense that your activities your activities as a as an activist of that Omar al-Bashir case. Do you understand that? And I also want to know about this NGO that you work for. Because this NGO, we see them when there are issues against the state more often. But on issues that unite the community in South Africa and so on, we don't see such organizations. So I want you to also make comments around that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. Good evening, Ms. Ramjetan Keo, did I pronounce it correctly? I think it's a good thing that you work in human rights litigation in the NGO and civil society sector is not palatable to government. We're not here to appoint a government protector. We're here to appoint a public protector, a person who fights on behalf of South Africans in the public, not government. So it's a good thing.
Your question, ma'am.
How about whom?
Giving the member the opportunity to ask the question, she's making a speech.
Everyone else made long preambles.
Honorable,
give me my chance, please.
Can you proceed? The floor is yours.
What I was saying is the work that you do in human rights litigation, it does not matter whether government likes it or not. You're here to fight on behalf of the public.
It's your only point of order.
What is your point of order?
No. My point of order is that you have noted a set of people to speak, but he's now not answering a question, responding to what I have said. He can't respond to what I've said. He must, in principle, ask a question.
Can I be allowed to preside over this meeting?
I don't know
why. Don't entertain that. Can you proceed, Honorable Van Damme?
You're not going to tell me what to say.
Honorable
so
Van
what
Damme,
I am saying
you
is, you are. If we appoint you as public protector, you're guaranteed to have a very antagonistic relationship with government. And clearly, some members here are already very touched about the great work you're doing in the public sector. So how would you deal with an antagonistic relationship that you will have with government? How would you deal with that?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Over to you.
Okay. The first question was in response to the documents I've submitted and was about my civil society background and my background as a public interest lawyer. And you wanted to know why I presented myself in this way. And to explain that, a lot of public interest work and public interest litigation is involved in challenging the state and its delivery to indigent individuals, vulnerable individuals, public service issues. These are challenging the state to deliver in terms of their commitments that they've made to the country and to the individuals in the country. That is the role of public interest organizations. It is a role which is not always well received by government because it is challenging government. And that's all I meant by that statement, is this is the background I've come from. I want to present to you precisely who I am. This is who I am. As regard to the issue of fit and proper, a fit and proper individual is somebody who is honest, who acts with integrity, who is reliable, and who has a reputation for being honest and reliable and somebody who acts with integrity. There was a question, the second question was about transformation and implementation and how to implement issues if I am selected as public protector. I think somebody in this position who is selected as public protector has to be true to the mandate of that office, has to be true to ensuring that they are protecting the Constitution and implementing the Constitution in their day-to-day work and the cases and the complaints that are reported to their office. Then there was the question about the closure of regional offices and financial resources. I'm not aware of all the financial arrangements around the Public Protector's Office. I think it's unfortunate that regional offices are closing down and that services are not as accessible as they should be. If I am selected, I will make a huge effort to try to attract more financial resources. I'm not aware of precisely which financial resources are available to the Office of the Public Protector, whether they can only use resources from government or whether external resources may also be sought. That could be something to look at if it was possible. I do have, working in the NGO sector means that I do have to engage in fundraising and liaising with donors. If it's possible to liaise with external non-government donors, that could be something which we look at together. There was a question about the separation of powers and the three arms of government and looking at somebody in the legislature for financial impropriety. I can't see this as a special case. The role of the Public Protector is to look at impropriety, financial impropriety. That is something that should be done in their day-to-day work as a matter of course, regardless of where it's coming from. And if it comes from the legislature, that needs to be dealt with the same as any other sector of government. The fourth question also asks questions about fit and proper. Who is a fit and proper person, which I've spoken to already, and also spoke to independence. And on the independence issue, independence in this context would be somebody who is independent of external as well as internal influences, including influences from government and political parties, and this includes all political parties, ruling parties, opposition parties, regardless. Independent would mean somebody who takes whose actions are independent as well as their decision making. This was asked in the context of the Bashir case and national unity. And I think it's very important to state in this instance that South Africa is a signatory to the Rome Statute. We've implemented domestic legislation in light of the Rome Statute. And we have an obligation to arrest any person for whom there is an international arrest warrant. And President Bashir was one such person. He stands accused of war crimes. Previously, when he tried to come to this country, he was advised by the state not to come because he would be arrested. He tried to attend President Zuma's inauguration in 2009 and was asked not to come. There were several options available to the state in this instance. They could have asked him not to come. They could have arrested him when he arrived. The state chose to do none of this. The Southern Africa Litigation Center proceeded against the state to compel the state to live up to its obligation to domestic statutes, its obligation to international statutes. That was what we did. This is a state obligation. The state failed in its obligation, and the Southern Africa Litigation Center was holding the state accountable. In terms of relating this to national unity, I think there are issues of national unity and political considerations, but there are also state obligations and adherence to the rule of law. And this situation was one where we had to adhere to the rule of law and ensure that South Africa doesn't become a safe haven for war criminals. I've also been asked to comment on my organization, the Southern Africa Litigation Center, and who we are and what we do. And as I've said in my introduction, we are a regional non-governmental organization based in Johannesburg. We operate in 10 Southern African countries. That is the primary focus of our work. We do very little work in South Africa, but one program area which operates in South Africa is the International Criminal Justice Program, which is precisely where the Bashir case fell within, And that's the reason why, because it was such a high-profile case, the organization's name became known. People were saying, who is this organization? We've operated very quietly previously. Because we operate regionally, nobody's very interested in what we do and how we do it. But because we brought this case that was in the media for weeks and weeks, there were questions about who is this organization. We are a human rights organization committed to the rule of law, committed to strengthening human rights. I was also asked a question about an antagonistic relationship with government. I have addressed this already in the course of my deliberations. If you're going to litigate against government, you're going to have an antagonistic relationship with government. This does not necessarily mean that the Office of the Public Protector needs to have an antagonistic relationship with government. I can be friends with government. I'm happy to be friends with government. I'm very happy and willing to work with government. And I will bring this to the Office of the Public Protector.
Thank you. Before I give you an opportunity, can I also, as the chair, have an opportunity to ask a question? I give you a lot of chance to ask questions. I've been facilitating. Now I need to ask. Okay. Members, can I ask my question? One, ma'am, part of the reason why you were shortlisted was precisely because some of the members that motivated for your name was that you are bringing the perspective, the international justice system perspective. And that was one of the considerations when your name was put forward. Now, I wanted to check with you whether you are sincere. You are saying, as a Chapter 9 institution, as which you know very well, you are all there to strengthen a constitutional democracy. And you are now saying, yes, there may be times when you have an antagonistic relationship with the state, but you are very happy to be friends with the state. Under which circumstances will you be friends with the state? The second one, ma'am, is I just wanted to get your appreciation, especially because of the role you played in the Al-Bashir matter. If you could kindly just share with us your views, briefly, your views on your African geopolitical dynamics. Because there is that, we may have different perspectives we just want to get that element from you. I'm just taking this opportunity because that's one of the reasons why we thought it's going to be very important for you to be shortlisted. The other thing that I also wanted to get from you, ma'am, what are your views on the international justice system? Notwithstanding the fact that South Africa is a signatory, but there has been a school of thought, and that school of thought which has been saying the international justice system has tended to be much harsher when it comes to African countries as opposed to your superpowers from the West. And I'm just using this opportunity because you are bringing this interesting perspective, and I think it will be good if we allow you an opportunity to comment on that. I thank you. I now can recognize the members. I was very short. I'm very fair. Oh, thank you. And you are very good. Honorable Masondo, Honorable Shivambu, Honorable Swart, and Honorable Mwabe. And I'm going to close with Honorable Bredenbach And if you can take the jot down the questions, this is your last round, so you will have enough time to respond and even to close with that punching marks afterwards. Thank you. Yes, Honorable Member Masondo.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. You know, post 1990 almost, or 1994, if one to be fairly general in what you want to say with respect to this matter, funding had become a very big problem for non-governmental organizations across the country. So when we see these many organizations, including your organization, we are bound to ask many, many questions. But I want to raise a few questions, Chairperson. I try to be brief. The first one is that here's an organization that operates in 10 countries, a minimum of 10 countries in Africa. And not much is known about you. So I really request that you explain to us just a bit more. Who are you? If the chairperson so allows, who are you? Secondly, the Al-Bashir case was really indeed a very high-profile case. Can you briefly just tell us how much the case cost you and where you got the funding from, obviously? Secondly, I'm not talking to this chap.
You
know,
just you. I am protecting you, and that is why I'm intervening. You are protected.
Sometimes the arrogance of some of these individuals know no bounds. So the question I'm asking, Chairperson, is who is funding you? And who is funding your funders? Just keen to know, I mean, who's funding your funders? Is this organization foreign controlled and foreign run? Is it? I mean, I just want to know.
I'm entitled to ask the question. That's not correct.
Honorable Swart. Chair, no other institution was asked those type of questions.
Okay.
Why is she being asked those questions?
Let me help you with this. You know, honorable members, the good news is that the members are wide awake. And that is why we can hear every word that each member is saying. Can you proceed, Honorable Masondo?
And as I was asking the question, who are you? One of the things that really would really assist me in understanding you a bit better is what are the aims of the Southern African Litigation Center and whether you have do intend or do in all these other countries have political alliances? And if so, who these are? You talked about changing the state, to use your words, changing the state. Does this mean the same thing as regime change, as advocated by some people in Libya, Egypt, in relation to what has happened in Libya, Egypt, and elsewhere? And when you were to be appointed the the public protector.
Honorable Masson,
what is it that you'll bring onto the table?
I want to remind you of our 3 minutes maximum rule.
No, not three minutes.
I think I will have to revoke that one. Okay? Oh, he's done now. Honorable Shivam.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will assure you before I say anything that I won't ask the kind of question which were asked by the former mayor of Johannesburg.
Just ask your question, Honorable Shifa.
The second last mayor to come from the liberation movement to ever could rule Johannesburg. There will never be any other one anytime soon. Now, the litigating against a state doesn't define any lawyer to be an enemy of the state. It's a very sore interpretation. Anyone who believes that is reactionary, doesn't understand constitutional democracy and whatever. If you litigate against the state, you're not the enemy of the state. It's allowed within our constitutional right and principles that lawyers and advocates can litigate against anyone. I want to test your philosophical commitment to the prosecution you did on President al-Bashir, that, you know, in the context of international peace and justice, there is always an interesting and ongoing discussion of what is the relationship between peace and justice. Do you sometimes pursue justice at the expense of peace? You do not have to go very far to check how that had been experimented. Here in South Africa, there was a deliberate pursuit of peace at the expense of justice when the apartheid murderers were forgiven through a TRC process. There are lots of people who killed our people, most of whom are still not found today, who beheaded our forefathers, who are still living in our society today. But there was deliberate pursuit of peace for a transition to happen. And obviously turning one blind eye on the justice factor. But you are saying that, no, let us pursue justice even if it might invite terrorists from North Africa, from Sudan, to come and fight for their president, whom they so worship, wherever he comes from. And you say, let us arrest him and we must not consider anything else. I don't know what pursuit of justice is that. What underpins that philosophically? Because there are many cases in the whole continent where certain transitions and political stability need to deal with the peace question first, and then stability of the country, then you'll deal with justice issues later. And I think South Sudan plays that role. You must not be narrowly legalistic when you are dealing with an extremely sensitive issue. There's more than 400,000 people that have been killed in South Sudan. That number could have doubled if you had insisted on arresting a president of a different country here. Like in a manner in which we have argued our point before in parliament that it's extremely narrow ideologically and philosophically and politically and in whatever way to could think that you can implement the Rome Statute in the narrow fashion that you wanted to pursue it. Even if South African law says that we should do it, it's extremely problematic in the manner in which it has been pursued. And I think that is one thing that you must have to look into, particularly if you are associating yourself as part of the civil society movement that cares about the interest of ordinary people. As part of the key challenges, number two, as part of the key challenges that you are identifying, confronting society, you quote Justice Sandile Ngcobo. And then you identify as well part of the issues as access to land. Would you, as a candidate, as a public protector, would you, as the South African Litigation Center, support a constitutional change of Section 25 that would say that the state should have the capacity to expropriate land without compensation and give it to all people, because currently is still owned by those who are descendants of the colonial murderers, those who beheaded our people, those who killed everyone to take the land that they're occupying now, those that have committed land theft, they've taken everything, they've declared us foreigners in our own country. would support a constitutional change, a proper constitutional change, not land invasion. Someone was asked earlier, we said constitutional change, then they spoke about Zimbabwe. We're not speaking about what happened in Zimbabwe. Not land invasion, constitutional change that says we should expropriate land without compensation to give to our people. Would you support such? You said now when you're responding to the questions that you are not fully aware of the public protector's financial arrangements and how the monies work there. Why are you applying for the job if you do not know how the monies are going to be dealt with there? Because the public protector's office...
I want to remind you of that 3 minutes.
The public protector's office has to reach out to so many people. Part of the limitations which the incumbent public protector has was to reach out to as many communities and municipalities as possible. And the reason was financial constraint. So if we were to say you are a public protector tomorrow, how are you going to deal with that question? Because now you do not know how the monies are going to, you are still going to go through induction, and before you know it, most people are not getting access to the public protector. We need someone who's going to hit the ground running. How are you going to deal with that?
Thank you, Honorable Member. Honorable Swart, I do agree with that aspect. I have to be very careful, you see. That aspect on justice and peace versus peace, that aspect, I'm looking forward to listening to that, answer. The rest, they his. Okay. Thank you. Honorable Swart?
I think, Chair, just on that very issue, when we refer to 400,000 people having been killed, that surely is why you brought the application, because there's no voice for those 400,000 people. But it is very interesting as well that the response of certain members on this panel is very similar to the response of the Nkandla judgment, as we see the al-Bashir judgment. But we're also aware that the al-Bashir judgment is still subject to the Constitutional Court hearing. Now, you asked a question about the cost. I'd like to ask you, what did it cost the state to pursue this, where it was then found that the state acted unlawfully? And that, I would think, is something that we also bear in mind when you are an NGO that is litigating against the deep pocket of the state. Can I just ask you then, in a general context of, let's talk about the public protector, should you be appointed to the public protector's position? The issue, of course, relates to management, and whilst you're an excellent litigant, you've had a great success, the skills of managing a large office with a couple of hundred million rands budget, do you think that you are suitably qualified to manage an office and liaise with Parliament, which under circumstances which could be quite contentious, which could be quite volatile, as you experienced tonight? I think that does prepare you for such engagements as well. But management skills is a big issue that we've needed to look at. And then as far as the financial budgeting of the Office of the Public Protector is concerned, we know they've got severe financial constraints. We as Parliament obviously need to look at that, but we've also got constraints from the budgetary side of things. What other alternatives could you suggest to assist the public protector in meeting its needs when it comes to finances? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Swarte. That was nice and crisp. I didn't have to interrupt you. Honorable Mwabe.
Thank you, Chair.
You are still coming, Honorable Breitenbach. I'm sure you are learning a few lessons.
I hope my 3 minutes starts now. Thanks, Chair. Greetings to Ms. Kajal. Chair, I will try to have my question not much complicated, but I will ask it. Ms. Kajal, on section 2 of your questionnaire, 2.1, where you were asked to explain why you believe you are the right person to serve as the next public protector, in the middle of the first paragraph on your responses, you explain the issue of your relationship with the international funders. And I'll just quote this sentence. As a result, I know the international donor environment very well and have established good relationships with donors that may continue to be important to both the office of the PP and government, unquote. And this line makes me very worried, ma'am. Very worried. Say you are appointed as the next public protector, and obviously you continue with this friendship with these international donors, and then they fund the office of the public protector, as we are saying, they might be important to that. Now, I want to know from you, how will you handle the pressure from these international donors in case they develop interest in South African politics, especially this office that is in question? I'm asking that question because anyone who gives you something might have some conditions or some attachments to that. I'm moving from, Chair, a real story of that we all know as politicians of the economic hitmen. We know how these international donors sometimes are capable of in developing countries. So that's my question, ma'am. How will you handle that pressure now when they start to have the influence over the office and South African politics? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, I think that aspect of your question, I like. Huh? Economic Hitman is a good book. Read it. I love that too. Yes, Honorable Breitenbach. Thank you, Honorable Breitenbach. Can you all copy this honorable member here? When you are covered, just say, I'm covered. That's very good. Okay. Yes, over to you, ma'am.
Thank you. Okay, so I was asked about international justice perspective and what my views are, and the situation of my views on the international criminal justice system and the problems with the ICC in what is perceived as a bias towards African countries. And to respond to that, the International Criminal Court is not a perfect institution. There are many issues and problems which need to be ironed out and resolved within the operation of the ICC. And my position is that South Africa will only be able to resolve these issues for South Africa's benefit by remaining with the ICC. You cannot influence change from outside. The African bloc within the ICC is the largest bloc of countries. Together, African countries within the ICC are strong, but they're not using this power as a strength. And that is one thing which I would recommend for African countries to do. They say they're unhappy with the ICC, but they're not using this very strong power that they have to liaise with the ICC on the issues that they have. We have seen a bias with African countries and heads of state who are referred to the ICC. And these are not African countries. These are heads of state and individuals who have been referred to the ICC. There are three ways in which referrals can be made to the ICC. These are self-referrals. A country can refer a situation by themselves. There's a Security Council referral, which is problematic because a number of permanent members of the Security Council are not members of the ICC. And then the prosecutor can also take up investigations if she feels that there is a problem in a particular country. So there's the three mechanisms. And a number of the investigations into African situations have been self-referrals. Uganda has done a self-referral. So it's not that These have come from within the ICC. They've been requests for assistance from countries. So, and then to complain about an African bias when countries have requested the assistance is curious. There are a number of countries which are being investigated currently. There are no charges. The investigations are still at very early stages, which are from non-African countries. These are Georgia, Colombia, Israel. So there are investigations which are ongoing, but we haven't yet seen the final outcomes and whether any charges might be forthcoming. We are watching these situations. We want to see what happens. We are interested to develop international criminal justice law. We're interested to see that it does not only target African states and African countries. So these developments are encouraging. I was asked by Mr. Masondo about my organization, so I will give you more background on my organization. This is the Southern Africa Litigation Center, not the South Africa, because of the regional perspective. The Southern Africa Litigation Center was formed in 2005, so we're currently 11 years old. It was formed jointly as an initiative by the International Bar Association and OSISA, which is the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa. And it was formulated as an organization that would support public interest work in Southern African countries in a way that hadn't been done before. So it would support non-governmental organizations, private lawyers, individuals to take on public interest cases and to support them financially and technically. So to support them in the drafting of their court papers, to strengthen those court papers so that they are strategic, they improve the jurisprudence in those countries, and in so doing, they protect the rule of law and they secure the interests of human rights in those countries. So that is the background to the formulation and to the formation of the Southern Africa Litigation Center. The organization operates in several different program areas. And I'll run down the program areas so you have an understanding of the broad overview. So there's freedom of expression work, which is looking at media defense work. So if journalists are arrested for writing articles, if they're being persecuted for working on certain media issues, we will assist them in their defense, in their issues. We work on health rights, which includes health rights, HIV, TB, a range of health-related issues within the Southern African context. HIV, of course, is the biggest issue. The case that we did in Botswana, where we challenged the government to provide antiretrovirals for HIV-positive foreign prisoners, which they had refused to do, was within the health rights context. We work on sexual and reproductive health rights. We had a very big case in Namibia a few years ago where we challenged the forced sterilization of HIV-positive women, which was successful. The government is now negotiating with these women on a civil settlement. There are similar forced sterilization cases under investigation in other jurisdictions as well. We work on women's land and property rights. So to secure the rights of women to access property on divorce, on death, in terms of customary law, all of this work operates very quietly. It's not high-profile work. The media is not interested to cover it, which is why you don't know about it. We work on international criminal justice, which you know about because of the Bashir case. We work on sexual minorities, which is promoting the rights of LGBTI individuals and sex workers. In a number of countries that we operate in, same-sex acts are criminalized, so it's very difficult to promote health access and the rights of these individuals in those countries. We had a very important Supreme Court decision in Botswana earlier this year, where the Supreme Court held that an LGBT advocacy organization must be registered to operate because they promoted health rights and welfare rights of individuals who are sexual minorities in those in that country, even though Botswana still criminalizes same-sex acts. This was an extremely progressive judgment coming out of that country. And generally, we work on rule of law and access to justice cases if there is a huge strategic value to taking those cases on. So that is the scope of the work. Who is funding SELC? We are funded by a range of different organizations. We're funded by the Open Society Foundation. We receive funding from private foundations like the Sigrid Rousing Foundation. We receive money from the U.S. Department of State, which funds our sexual minorities work. This is the work promoting the rights of LGBTI workers, LGBTI persons and sex workers. In respect of the Bashir case, and in terms of the question about cost, the initial cost of that first urgent application, which we ran in June 2015, incurred us zero cost. The papers were drafted by us in our offices. We retained counsel at a pro bono rate. Well, actually, I say pro bono rate, but we didn't pay counsel for that fee. It was done on a no-fee basis. So all of the drafting, our appearance, counsel's appearance for us in court was done at zero cost to the organization. And this is because we hadn't anticipated that Mr. Bashir would arrive in the country. We hadn't planned for his arrival. Once we heard that he was actually going to arrive and was in the country, we very quickly drafted an application, put it together, and filed it late at night on a Saturday evening, which also is unusual. So I can tell you that that original High Court application didn't cost us any money. However, we've had to defend it subsequently in the Supreme Court, and we will now again defend the Bashir application in the Constitutional Court on the 22nd of November. This is because the state is taking it on appeal. We were successful with the original High Court application. It has now been taken on appeal to the Supreme Court of South Africa, and the state has lost. It's now been taken on a further appeal to the Constitutional Court. We've had to seek funds to continue to defend this matter. These funds we've received from the Wraith Foundation, which is a South African foundation. So South African RANDs are funding the ongoing defense of this case. The Wraith Foundation is an organization based in Johannesburg that receives its money from high net worth individuals in RANDs. There was the question about whether my organization is foreign controlled. I'm surprised at this question, and I take deep offense at this question, Mr. Masondo. My organization is not foreign controlled. I will say it again. SELC is not foreign controlled. We are an independent human rights organization that are working towards the constitution of this country and the constitutions of all the countries that we operate in. We are true to our mandate and our vision. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. On the question of political alliances, the Southern Africa Litigation Center is an independent NGO. We do not have political alliances in this country or in any other country. So to answer your question about who are these alliances, there are no alliances. We are who you see that we are. And then I think you misheard me when you've asked me a question about why does this organization want to change the state? I'm not finished yet. I didn't say change the state. I said challenge the state. which is very different from change the state. Challenge the state to deliver. I'm going to move on to the other questions.
Can members behave? I can hear you, Vanda, Robert, or whatever. I can hear you going. Keep that to yourself. Okay, proceed, ma'am.
Moving on to Mr. Shivambo's questions about my philosophical commitment to international peace and justice and pursuing justice at the expense of peace. First of all, and we are talking about Sudan, not South Sudan. President Bashir is president of Sudan, not South Sudan. I think you're asking me this question under the presumption that President Bashir is essential for peace in Sudan. That is a matter for debate. It is not a sine qua non. It's not an essential element. We don't know this. We don't know that President Bashir is essential for the peace process in Sudan. And bringing the application the way we did, we are a human rights organization that is accountable to the law of this country, to the Constitution, and we brought this application in light of those commitments. So the rule of law and our commitment to upholding domestic laws was uppermost in our minds when we brought this application. There was not considerations about the peace process in Sudan. It was a strictly legal application. And if the state were interested to avoid becoming embroiled in this difficulty, they could have asked Mr. Bashir to not arrive in this country. When we heard he was arriving, a month earlier, we wrote to the government saying, reminding them of their obligations and saying, if he does arrive, we will have to seek his arrest. They were forewarned and took no steps to mitigate against this. I won't speak any further on this. There was a question also on the peace process and about ordinary Sudanese. And I just want to ask the question, President Bashir is accused of a range of human rights violations, war crimes, genocide, international crimes, atrocious international crimes. Who will seek justice for the victims of those crimes and their families? Who will speak for those individuals? It's organizations like SELK in this country and in other countries that can seek justice for those victims. These victims cannot get justice in Sudan. It's not possible in the current situation. Do they have to wait 50, 60 years like the situation where that we've just seen in Senegal with the prosecution of the Chadian president? Those individuals have waited 50, 60, 70 years to see justice. Is this what we want to see in Sudan? I don't think so. We want justice now. Mr. Shivambo has asked me a question about the land issue and constitutional change and expropriation of land. I do not support the expropriation of land. It's not an easy answer here. I cannot give you an easy solution to this question. There were more questions about Bashir and the cost of the application. There was a question about the cost to the state. I don't know what the cost to the state is. I don't know what the state was paying its advocates to defend the matter, to bring the first appeal, to bring the second appeal. I can only imagine that they are substantial costs because they've employed senior counsel, very expensive senior counsel. However, because we have also engaged counsel who we now will have to pay for. The state will have to pay its own costs. They will also have to pay our costs. So the costs are likely to go into hundreds of thousands of rands of taxpayer money to defend this matter, which initially cost us zero rands. To speak about the questions on my management experience, I have been managing people, I've been managing staff, teams of staff for a number of years. I have not managed the kinds of numbers of staff that are currently within the institution of the Office of the Public Protector. I've managed many teams at Lawyers for Human Rights. My overall staff complement at Lawyers for Human Rights was anywhere in the region of 25 to 30 people at any one time in multiple locations. At SALC, I manage a much smaller team, but this is also multiple locations because we operate in 10 countries, or we have ongoing cases in 10 countries. We've got to manage those cases and those individuals running those cases directly in those countries on a day-to-day basis. It does entail a good degree of management, of budgetary control, of financial management. I have also not managed the kinds of budget that the Public Protector's Office deals with. At Lawyers for Human Rights, an annual budget which I manage would be in the region of 8 to 9 million rands. At SALC, the budget, the organizational budget, is in the region of 15 million rands. In both organizations, I've received unqualified audits for many years in a row. So, you know, it's a testament to those management abilities, but of course the Public Protector has much bigger budgets, which I have not had occasion to manage. And finally, there were questions about relationships with donors and international donors. I have listed some donors that we've worked with, and there was a question about pressure from international donors. And preconditions and strings. And I can say categorically that I do not work with donors, or I will refuse to accept donor money that arrives with strings. If a donor says, you need to implement this program in this way, that is not acceptable. If you present a proposal to a donor to say, I want to do this project in this area for this amount of money, will you support me? If they give you the money without any strings, I would accept that money. If that comes with strings attached, I would not accept that money. I hope that is clear. I think that is it.
Thank you, thank you, thank you very much. I'm actually glad that we actually, with this committee, by the way, took a decision that we wanted to make sure that when we are shortlisting candidates, we also want a very strong gender representation. And I'm sure we have indicated now, because we've been, you know, we've had quite a number of women that have been coming in, and this is not saying you've done well or you didn't do well, but I'm just saying as a statement that I think it was good that we made that effort. And I'm glad. I don't think I have a frustrated expectation. Thank you very much. Do you have another question, Honourable Member?
Chair, I just wanted to indicate that some very offensive comments were made, and I think that they should be withdrawn, because we haven't treated any other person making submissions like we treated the advocate today. And to create the impression that she is foreign controlled, I think, is totally unacceptable, and it should be withdrawn, Chair.
Honourable Masondo, is that what you meant? Excuse me, I am talking to Honourable Masondo, and as far as I know, there's only one Honourable Masondo. Can you clarify that, Honourable?
No, I'll never ever withdraw, not in this meeting. Not anywhere else, because I posed a question, and that question remains.
Okay. I think, ma'am, he has posed the question, and you have responded to the question. If there has been any offense on your side, This is not the intention of this interview. As I said to you, one of the reasons why the members actually said you need to be shortlisted, it's because you are bringing that international dimension. We may not agree with your views. Get us correct. We may not agree with your views, but you can articulate your views, and you are making them clear. And I think that should be appreciated. And I thank you. We shall hear from us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Shivambo, hi, hi. Listen, let me tell you what we're going to do. We were going to have Advocate Nonkosi Cetshwayo. And then after that, we're going to break for dinner and have a nice break in between then. And then you are actually doing very well. I think you are very harsh on yourself.
Let's go for break.
You wanted to go to the ladies?
Yeah.
Okay, to the gents. Well, I think you are allowed to go there. Okay,
Chairperson,
no, that's fine.
We
are still
for
waiting.
A break.
You
we'll
can
come.
Go. Let's just stretch for 2 minutes.
Please.
And whilst we are waiting for the next candidate to come through. Thank you.